Hi, I'm Ben Collins. Welcome to Some Say, my podcast series, which is all about fascinating car stories. Now, as some of you may know, for many years, I was the man in the white suit on Top Gear, and I was famous for not really saying very much at all. But in this series, I'll be interviewing some fascinating people from all over the world, from the worlds of cars and motorsport. Richard Porter, the script editor, the original writer of the Top Gear series. Jim Wiseman, the original researcher, then producer and series producer of Top Gear. Boys,
yes.
This is actually the car I wanted to talk about, even though it's a 968. It's reminiscent of the 928,
yes.
which takes us back to the South American special.
Oh, okay? Yes.
Now, you write for a living, you're a wordsmith. Were you involved in some of the preparation for the Argentina shoot?
I was, yeah.
Because I found that episode, I'd left Top Gear at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Same here.
You had also left. And as a fan, and we're watching the show, that all seemed to be quite a coincidence with the whole license plate.
Yeah, it was. And people always go...
Do you buy that?
No comment, Your Honour.
Well, because, first of all, Jeremy wanted a 928. It wasn't a club sport, was it? What was the one he wanted? A GT. Very rare variant. And I remember him going...
And they only came in Falklands...
They only came
with Falklands 1982
Well, that's the thing. There were two of them for sale. Because the thing was, the whole premise of the film was that it was a goodbye to the V8 engine. So each presenter of the brief was, pick a car with a V8. And he went, yeah, I want a 928. And he went, no, wait, I want a 928 GT, because that was my favourite version of the 928. And so one of our researchers, who's still a friend of ours, went online and she found two... for sale. That was all that was out there. So she called both numbers and both adverts, and only one of them replied. And it was
the other
car.
Ones had Vietnam written on the yeah. one had one had the Falklands.
Well, because the thing was, we were discussing in the office, you know, shenanigans and whether it was like, oh, do we do some slogans and things like that? And then, as was customary, someone from the team or two people from the team went out there on a recce and came back and went, guys, it would be really bad to do shenanigans because feelings are still running very high out there. And I remember talking to Jeremy about it and I went, so you're happy we don't do any shenanigans? He was like, we can't. Like, I think he'd had it impressed on him how dangerous it was out there if we mucked around. So the car, because we went back and looked at the ad, the plates were blanked out in the ad. The car was inspected by a Porsche mechanic. He went, yeah, it's good, at the seller's house. And then it was stuck on a truck into a crate across the Atlantic because otherwise it wouldn't be there in time.
So no one saw it?
No one from the production saw it. And even when they did, they kind of went, oh, it's a nice car, that. And it wasn't until someone online went, oh, look, Top Gear in town, they've got this comedy plate on the car. But that had been on the car since it was registered new in whenever it was, 91. So we would have had to track that car down. And then, luckily, it was for sale, which, of course, is impossible because how would you... Or... we'd have had to retro-engineer it, gone, oh, look, there's a car for sale with an inflammatory Argentinian number plate. Let's go to Argentina with it, which would have been a really cock-assed way of doing things.
It looked suspicious, didn't it?
I could because see why people thought it was suspicious.
Extra because plates
exactly
the in
sort
the
of
car
nonsense
as well.
That we would do. Yeah. Well, they were retroactively brought over by a member of production who went later because it was like, right, we've got a problem here, what do we do? Have some dummy plates made up and we can put those over the thing. But by the time they got out there, it was too late.
So I listened to the interview with the police, the local policeman, and he was saying, you know, I can't remember what he was saying, but he was obviously pissed off. And then they'd seized the car at this point and pulled out the license plates that were in there.
Yeah.
And it was B-E-L-L-E-N-D.
Yeah.
And he said, and we don't think this is referring to the shape of a bell. So there was this extra set of plates which made it look even worse.
Yeah, because we were like, okay, well, let's just do a scene where, like, I mean, obviously this doesn't check out from a story point of view. It's like somehow Hammond and May have found a place that makes British number plates in Argentina. But this was the way we were going to sort of try and smooth it over for the rest of the trip, was get some plates made up. Someone from production was going out halfway through the shoot, take these with you, and then we can just claim one night James and Richard prank Jeremy by putting some plates that say Bellend on his car.
He's flawless, isn't he?
It's
the truth. The thing is, he could easily get a job at the CIA.
I've been justifying this for ages, and I always go, I can see why people would think it was done deliberately, because it's exactly the sort of stupid shit we would have done. But on the other hand, it was far too subtle. We weren't that clever.
You are that clever.
I'm not.
You and Clarkson together. Dangerous.
Yes.
All right, I think it's a good...
I mean, I feel like I'm watching...
Is that it?
Oh, it's a good pass.
Sweaty
I thought
palm.
You didn't stutter once. Yeah. I believe your story. All right, we'll go back in and look at some other stuff then. There you go. That's a nice one.
Good.
Even if it is purple.
Silk cut purple, that's good.
Future classic.
Mm. Now I must press you for some more FAQs, please.
Frequently asked questions.
Yeah. All right, so here we go. So biggest waste of money on Top Gear show. Don't say you, Ben.
Apart from...
You were great value.
Yeah. Well, you'd have to say the pilot set was a good start.
Oh, yes.
Because that was massive. So we did this pilot episode.
The original Thunderdome.
When the man dressed the robot Stig came out. Mm. That was a huge thing. And then they went, no, it doesn't work.
So it was scrapped.
So it's scrapped. But yeah. That would have cost...
Because I remember the set designer came in and sat down and with Wilman, and he was going, so yeah, I see what you mean. It's not really working. So I've had some thoughts. What I'm going to do is I think I can reconfigure this. And Wilman went, no, I want you to take it outside and burn it. And that was it. And so then we did another pilot with no set whatsoever.
Yeah.
Just an empty room with some cars in it, which was too much. And then we'd run out of time.
Yeah, no, and money. So that's why it's that really shit track. Do you remember that on the old studio there was like track with a really bad, like a 12-year-old.
Yeah. I think it has been done by a local primary school. Also, another good waste of money in that it was just an idea that didn't work. Very first series, we suddenly went, oh, wait a minute. If it rains some weeks, that's not fair cars that lap then or celebrities that lap then. So the answer is to level the playing field, make sure the track is always wet. Yeah.
Basically, we've got this local water tanker who'd just done the drains or like from the council. And then they very quickly, he turned up and was like, well, I won't be able to do the whole track. So we're like, oh,
do the racing line.
No, so what they did was they did the corners.
Yeah.
All right, well, do the corners. So we did the corners. And then there was just literally foul. There was just shit everywhere. The come out, because he'd done someone's drains or he was a council guy. The first dig, Perry, who was very good,
he went
out in the Zonda to do a lap. It was an early program. And of course, it was really hot, so he did a dry line within about three laps.
Yeah.
So it was completely pointless. So we never referred to it on the show.
No.
But the Zonda was covered in this crap. And I remember me and the other researcher, Roland, had to go and clean it. And so we went to clean it. So we got buckets out with sponges. And the guy who brought it, who was like the UK, got wind of this and came up. Stop it! And like was having a go at us, and me and Ron were like, he's getting his car clean for free. What was
it? It's covered in human feces.
We got sponges and stones in. Just going, I don't know what his problem is.
Like a 5-year-old. I'll help.
If you watch that first, it's probably in the first episode, isn't it? Which is on iPlayer again. They've put them all on iPlayer.
Yeah.
And that first episode, I think, is the Pagani goes round. Yeah, Lamborghini goes round. And if you look closely, you can see these sort of dry patches of human feces on the corners.
Yeah. Nice. So the space shuttle, do you remember that? Yes. So I was told that was my favourite segment. And that, you had a Reliant Robin with wings.
Yeah.
And so we watched it went up and then it crashed into the ground. Yeah. But it was meant to separate. And I was told that actually the only thing that failed on that was the separation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
so
in fact,
it was like bolt, wasn't it? It was explosive
if it had
bolt,
come off, this was designed to fly two laps of the airfield.
It was going to glide, I think, because we'd experimented with
flying cars
before.
So it didn't have propulsion.
It didn't have propulsion. Flying cars, one of the worst.
There's a waste of money.
Yeah, that was a waste of money.
Trying to make a flying car.
Very difficult.
Worked
but
with.
The wings were made of polystyrene, which I wasn't sure that they would have stayed on.
The shuttle wings.
No, the shuttle one. What I'll say on the shuttle is, what a moment, A. B. I'd worked with these guys, these Rocketeers, they were called, on the mini down the ski slope.
Yep.
They were brilliant. And what they managed to achieve was extraordinary. And they were really, really good. And
the
so.
The largest rocket launch on British soil or
on
something.
British
wasn't
soil.
It? Yeah, it was pretty.
Was the shuttle.
Yeah. But obviously, as you'll know, the Reliant Robin fiberglass, no engine, no innards in it, so very light. I think it would have worked because these guys were. They were from Manchester or somewhere, weren't they?
Yeah, Glossop, I
stood with them with the Mini at the top of the ski jump. The whole crew, we were waiting for this thing to go off. So they'd loaded up an old school Mini, and there was, as far as I could see, about sort of 10 rockets in the back of it, using, is it rubber?
Yes, rubber's the fuel,
And at the top of the sort of giant ski, it was a skiing jump, when you look actually at the top and you look down, you barely even see the landing slope, which is huge itself. And at the bottom, there is a vast collecting area, which flattens out. Mm. But from the top, it looks the size of a beer mat. And then it's just mountain, and you could see an entire village of whole people, all these lights on, all these human beings that sort of lived below. And I looked down the barrel of this jump again and looked at the beer mat and the village. I said, well, what if it takes off and it could go past that? He said, well, we don't think that it will. And then, sure enough, it lit up and it went down. It was perfect, and it made the sound of the Millennium Falcon as it took off.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
There were some items as well that never even made air because they were so shit.
Oh, do you remember the bus?
Yes, yeah. The unfunny bus.
The unfunny bus. We had a bus, so the whole concept was
the
like,
double decker. We used to
it was
in.
The double decker that we have to move out of the studio each week. Right.
Yeah, there was a Route Master. Do you remember when they sold off the old Route Masters? And they were, I can't remember, five grand or ten grand?
So the premise was, like a Heineken ad, what if Top Gear did a bus, right? And it just didn't play very well. But we were lumbered with the
very
bus.
Very bad. Yeah, so we bought, at some expense, a Route Master because we went, oh, they're selling Route Masters, let's buy one. And it was Top Gear doesn't do public transport, but if we did, it would be the best public transport in the world. Yeah. And then came up with all these absolutely shit ideas for how we'd make buses better, including a Scalextric track that descended from the ceiling. And it wasn't Scalextric, it was smaller scale. It was about the size of a sheet of A4, and it was all bits of string came down. And it became known as the unfunny bus. Yeah. And even when we were moving it around, as we had to do every week, can someone just shift the unfunny bus? And James May, because it was James and Richard on the shoot, he came up with a song. Get on board, get on board. I think he imagined lots of harmonies and things, but I can't remember how the lyrics were.
Get on board the unfunny bus.
Get on board the unfunny bus.
Those buses are great, though. We did the bus racing at Lyddon Hill.
Yes.
And they were really hard to tip over.
We did people carrier racing, which was the first one of those. I remember putting a crash cam on the front of Matt Neal's people carrier. I said to Matt, look, give it a couple of laps and then just smash someone so the camera will break, it's fine, it goes to a recorder. Yeah, fine. Got in it, went to the grid, smashed into the guy in front of me because it was Anthony Reed.
and basically wanted
to go behind you. Yeah. It's like, you just smashed the camera before we even started.
Yeah. It's like, that was like that with the car football because they had Russ Swift, the precision driver, was in the mix. And he was like, right, this guy is the best in the world for handbrake turns and precision driving, all these things. With the giant ball, which was one of those mad ideas, because I originally suggested we did something with David Beckham or someone, try and do a corner kick, use the car to hit the ball into the goal. Then you came up with car football,
it kind of came from, they had some cars that they were willing for us to use, I think, there was a manufacturer involved.
Toyota went, we've got these pre-production IGOs and they're going to have to be scrapped or something, so you can have them to do what you want.
But we put the football field up and then I was like the referee, so basically, it's in, if you watch it, it's there. I'm putting the ball in the front and then I just had to peg it off sick. And then I had radios to all the cars and I had to be the referee. It was brilliant though. It worked really well.
Well, it was ironic because the touring, you would think the touring car and the racing people would be the worst, but it was Russ Swift. Like James Bryce, I think, directed it and he was really strict and he said, listen, this is how it's going to work. And he's like, he was working for Ridley Scott and he sounded a bit like Ridley Scott. Yeah. And we said, oh, he's like the headmaster. So you guys keep it on the down, keep it down low. As the shoot progresses, we will become more physical. But it was really clear, like the boundaries were set, no contact. And so I was like, I managed to get the ball and then just got thundered into, got T-boned.
Yes.
I looked across and I could just see Russ Swift with this really angry glare. And I thought, this is the precision man. And then absolutely, there was no quarter given at all. All right, so that wasn't a waste of money. Well, guests, we did talk about a few guests, but best guest.
Ooh.
So in, we talked about Terry Wogan, and that was amazing. For me, that was amazing. It was often the people that are childhood heroes and perhaps not with us anymore. So obviously,
he held out and he wouldn't do it for ages.
Yes.
And then finally, I think we upped the sort of meagre amount that we gave celebs to come on if they weren't plugging something. And he gave it to Children in Need.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's the mark of a man straight away. He just basically rinsed us for more money so he could give it to charity, which is like fair play.
Fair enough, And my other standout guest was Roger Daltrey from The Who.
Yeah.
Only because it gave me a story that I've been dining out on for years. I found myself, after he'd been on the track, urinating next to The Who's Roger Daltrey. And so I engaged in small talk, and I said, oh, how do you think you did out there? Do you think you did a decent time? And he just looked at me and went, couldn't give a fuck, mate. Life I've had. I was like, absolutely, absolutely. That is the perfect response you want from a rock and roll superstar. So, yeah.
It's not Shea Stadium, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wild man. All right, so that's best guests. Worst guest?
Well, in the very early days, one of the first guests we had was Vinnie Jones,
who
was
I missed Vinnie.
A little surly, I would say. And
Perry did that.
Yeah, that was
I think
Perry.
He got on very well. He was very
well,
good.
Perry gets Perry, on with everyone. Great, he's such a great guy.
Great guy.
Yeah,
great guy.
Good driver as well. Mm. So, yeah, he came into the original porter cabin that was the production office at the airfield, which was tiny and terrible.
Vinnie.
There was this little cupboard, was the celebrity green room.
Yes,
and
yes.
It was, I mean, it was quite insultingly bad. But we'd had Harry Enfield in there and JK, and they hadn't really made a fuss. And Vinnie Jones stuck his head into it and went, I'm not staying in this piss hole. And one of the researchers had to take him to the pub down the road for lunch.
Good on him.
And have a slightly awkward lunch. So he was definitely one of the more sort of surly ones.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, as you'd expect, really, if he was all sort of flowers and sunshine, you'd be like, what's wrong with Vinnie? So, yeah. I don't remember. Most people were really pleased to be there.
It was really good. And it was often people who go, oh, are they going to be? And they were fine. And because they were a bit nervous, they were fine. The only one, if I had to choose worst, or only because it was a bad experience, was David Walliams. Mm. You were there for that one, where he nearly killed us all.
Did he?
So he just ran, for some reason, he ran really wide on the last corner.
Well, it's not for some reason, it's for a very clear reason.
Didn't do enough steering.
He had mixed up the pedals. He turned the steering wheel loads. The car was understeer, the front had lost its grip. Mm. And he turned the steering wheel over, and instead of actually reaching for the brake, his foot was jammed into the throttle. So he was accelerating, wanting to brake, and his eyes had opened up like saucers.
Yeah.
And I was trying to offer helpful advice whilst jogging backwards to lift off the throttle.
That was
funny because I do remember that. We were all running for it, and I was really concerned about the sound man because it was in the days when they were still attached. And he tripped, and we were almost like pulling him like a toddler in reins because it was coming. And I just remember you running backwards going,
get off the wheel, get off the pedal.
You were doing all these like, and we were like, this is awful. This hasn't happened before.
Well, it's
and
good so, you had the presence of mind to try and deal with the situation while running
Felt
for your
slightly
life.
Slightly responsible, having taught this man, taught him to drive.
Mm. Yeah, but that would have happened under Perry's watch, obviously.
Well, he's so good, Perry, isn't he? Mm. Stephen Fry was really nice, as you'd hope. And again, hung around.
Richard Whiteley.
Richard Whiteley,
Richard Whiteley was a nice man. Hung around for lunch. We had a chat with him.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Tom Cruise. Yeah.
Tom Cruise also.
Yeah.
He was actually very good.
I thought he was awesome.
Wasn't he?
I can't remember. Yeah. She was faster in the wet, though.
Mm. Was she?
Yep.
Yeah.
And they both lapped in the rain, and understandably, he came back for a second bite.
Yeah.
Yes. Literally drove the
It mattered so much to him, I think, because he actually...
But he was genuine. I remember thinking, he knows what he's doing. So that was encouraging.
The only man I know who would feather the throttle while the car is tipping over.
He's
pretty, Top gun. Pretty brave chap. Mm. All right, so I've got one more here. Now, since you wrote them, it's difficult to say, but favourite Some Say line, and are any of them true?
I rewatched. Somebody has comped together all of the Some Say introductions on YouTube, so you can just watch them back to back, which I did, knowing I was coming here to do this. And I thought I'm going to remind myself of them. And I have to say, they didn't hold up as well as I'd hoped. So some of them I just went, oh, okay. It was always a thing. So what used to happen is that we would, on a Tuesday, we'd all meet in the office, me and the presenters, and we would go through the studio script. And I'd have written a draft of it. And that would include what I used to call the grouting, you know, like between the tiles, you've got to do the grouting, which was all sort of like kind of housekeeping, things that need to be there. So a menu for the top of the show, an intro for the Stig, an intro for the guest, whatever else, every week needed those things. And I would put in my sort of best shot and hope when the presenter sat down, and Jeremy would sit at the computer with the script on the screen, and I would watch him read it. And when he'd get to like the Stig intro, if he went, I'd be like, I've got him. Or sometimes he'd turn around and go, that's very good.
Yes.
And I'd be like,
oh.
And then sometimes he'd go, not sure about this one. And then we'd go through the thing. And then it would become a group effort. And James never quite got the hang of it, I think. He'd always get a bit too long. And he would go, what about some say when he first read Pythagoras' theorem? Like, no, James, it's too, that's already too wordy.
It's a paragraph.
So we'd sort of, we try and do these things. I liked the ones that were sort of just really silly and also kind of stuck in their own kind of internal logic loop, like some say he keeps a photo of his wallet in his wallet, or he has a tattoo of his own face on his face. Because they're quite good to deliver as well, I think. I mean, you'd have to ask Jeremy about this, but I think they're quite good because you do that. You've got the pause there. You can go, some say he keeps a photograph of his wallet in his wallet. So it's a good Clarkson delivery. There's one actually that made me laugh, and I could have completely forgotten it. I suspect Hammond came up with this himself because he did. He rarely did them, but one he did, he went, so, some say something, something bollocks. And then the second one, he went, and that I haven't done one of these for ages and I forgot to think of a second thing, which it seemed on this, when I was watching it back, got a really big laugh, which was good. It's the way he delivered it, it was just perfect. So yeah, my favourite would be something like keeps a photo of his wallet in his wallet just because it's stupid.
I like that. My favourite is because it was based on fact. Mm. We went to the Isle of Man and we spotted you waving at seals.
Oh yes.
And I just remember watching you waving at seals. And it made it, and some say that he waves at seals.
Yeah, yeah. So I think some of them
because
were just in
jokes. Because
it was
based upon,
Oh, that's what, actually, no, I'm just picking my own jokes, which is terribly egotistical. I think my favourite, though, is some say he knows two facts about ducks, and both of them are wrong.
I don't know.
I wanted those ones, which sometimes we'd argue ages about them, because, but I really liked it where it just painted a little bit of extra detail in this weird man's weird life. It's like there's this idea he's wandering around confidently stating two facts about ducks and they're both
whilst
bullshit.
Waving at seals.
Whilst waving at seals.
Why do you and Jeremy hate racing drivers? Because it comes out in your writing.
Don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm probably just
doesn't
jealous.
Deny it. I knew it. I
don't hate racing drivers.
You do, though. You do.
Not all of you.
I'm sure.
Whoa. That's a bit nerve, isn't it?
Come on.
Well, because I remember this. This was the whole basis of the Stig, and I remember Jeremy saying this. I think he said this in the studio. He did say it in the studio intro to the very first show when we introduced the Stig. He said racing drivers' opinions are meaningless. They just drone on about tyres. They're brilliant in the car and extremely tedious out of them. And then I wrote him a gag that was, we call this Mansell syndrome. And that was how we got into the Stig in the first place. It was always this like, don't speak, your talent is to drive, so that's all you will do. Yeah. For the record, when I went for, I didn't really have an interview for the new format of Top Gear because I already knew Jeremy and Andy and they wanted to hire me because they'd seen my website, Sniff Petrol, and they liked that tone, that kind of angle of trying to take the piss out of cars and not treat them too sort of reverentially. But I went in for a chat with them and they said, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a car show, but it's going to be based in a studio. And I went, oh, I don't think that'll work. And they went, no, it'll be fine, honestly. And then we're going to have a, you know, have a test track outside. We're going to have a racing driver who never speaks. And I was like, oh, no, that's not a good idea at all. So it shows how much I know, because basically the major format points of the show I thought were bollocks, but they actually worked quite well.
Well, Jeremy was very clear that I was an idiot and didn't know anything, but he wanted my opinion of each car I drove.
He does
that to everyone, that's fine.
So I did used to love our chats. All right, back to the FAQs. So did a car manufacturer ever refuse to give you a car?
Yes. So as far as I can remember, there's two.
Okay.
So first one is Bristol Cars.
Oh, yes. Bristol never really lent out cars anyway, but I think we decided
have
to have another go.
They did.
Because I remember trying to get a Bristol when I worked on old Top Gear as a researcher, and I got put through to Tony Crook, the man who owned Bristol, because I think there was only two people worked there, him and a receptionist. And he was a very well-spoken man, and he came on the phone. He said, you're from Top Gear. Your magazine described one of my cars as donkey shit. I mean, that's just ridiculous, isn't it? Imagine a car made of donkey shit. The smell alone would be unimaginable. And I realised he was just toying with me. He was never going to lend us a car.
Yeah.
And that was back in, you know, when it was, I think we wanted to do something with Quentin Wilson on them. And then, yeah, so then we tried again in the new era. And
no,
same.
No
dice.
Joy. The best one is the City Rover, where what happened was, obviously, Rover knew it was shit. And so just kept going, oh, no, they're all out. I remember calling the press office and going, it's a really important car, we've done it in the news, we want to... It's out. They're all out, it's all very popular, they're all out. So we ended up doing a covert shoot of the City Rover. So James went with a hidden camera into a dealership.
In a really horrible tie, which I think he was a bit distraught that people would think he actually dressed
tie
like
with a camera in
I need to watch this.
And it's great. Telling about it is this was early days, because James couldn't walk into a car dealer now and go, hello, I'm a normal person and would like to buy this car. Because they'd go, no, you're not, you're James May off Top Gear. Whereas then, it was probably his first series?
First or second, And then, so what was brilliant was, so we did this whole thing where we set up, so we knew he'd go on this little route round the car dealer, because I think the director had gone in and gone, can I test drive it? And wrecked the roads. So he knew that it would go like there was a little bit on the A3 or something. So I was in the slip road in the Fiat Panda, which was like its rival. So when I saw it go through and we had the radio, so he's left the thing, and da, da, da. And so I had to drive and get up alongside the City Rover so James could go, oh, look, it's the new Fiat Panda, the latest, you know, this is the opposition for this car. And I just remember James going, don't look at me because I'll start laughing. And I was like, so I went up alongside like this. And I, because I didn't want to look at him to make him laugh, it was kind of like quite difficult to keep level with him. It was like before pro, so that's how we used to do, us researchers used to do a lot of the driving on the other bits and bobs. And I just remember it being brilliant. And also, because it was like as live and we had people in vans and things like that, when he got back and it had finished, so we'd shot this whole VT in a morning. Yeah. So usually, as you know, it takes all bloody day and you're like, oh, it's going to get dark, it's going to keep going. We were done by lunchtime. We had a nice sit-down lunch.
Which never used to happen on shoots.
Never happens.
Okay, so one that I do get asked a lot. Did we fake the races?
Right. No. So
You were actually on them, weren't you?
So I did the first one, which was the Aston Martin versus the train.
I rewatched the end of that recently because my memory was that Jeremy was quite drunk at the end.
Drunk
and he watched the closing piece to camera. It's on YouTube.
It's such a great car.
It's a proper, spectacular Aston Martin. And he's got a glass of wine in his hand.
To be fair, that was a long day. Mm. And I set it up. So basically, what I used to do was timetable the train. So you know roughly, so the connections are there. And then I'd then do the maths on an average speed of 55 to 60 miles an hour, which was still quite tasty if you think about it, but it was certainly on that one, it was a lot of motorway. Mm. And so I based it upon that. And the first one wasn't that close, but we made it look closer through editing.
Jeremy was able to get very drunk and waiting
for the other two to arrive, where he went much quicker than I thought. Down the motorway,
the key, wasn't it? Back timing.
Exactly. So, but the second one was, which is the Verbier trip, which I remember being on the tube listening to two guys, and that's when I knew the show was big. I got on the central line, as I always did, across to White City, where the office was. And I remember two guys going, did you watch that last night on a Monday morning? And they were going, oh, that Verbier thing, that was unbelievable. I'm like, oh, okay, we're in the public consciousness now. So, but that was really close to the point where I had to give Jeremy a pep talk from the office on the phone because he was like, I'm not going to win this. I'm like, no.
You're going to be all right, champ.
You are. You just got to hit the average speed, right? Yeah. So the average speed is that. And then I had the director going, we're not going to win. We're not going. No. You are. Stop worrying about it and do the average speed, right? And that whole business where they got there together is absolutely genuine. And
the problem was that was so perfect, and people started going, well, they're just faking these, aren't they? And it's a bit like...
But it's the level of prep you put into it.
Yeah.
So basically, it was creating the ingredients for them to make it work.
Mm, it was a timetabling nightmare. And then, because you start kind of... Because you're knackered, as I said earlier, you always start going, oh, God, have I worked that out right? And then when the man from the television shouts at you down the phone, you're going to go, I'm kind of lying and saying you're going to be absolutely fine because I don't know this for 100%, but... I know that that's what you need to hear. And then you go back and you do it and you're like, I think it's going to be there. And it worked out.
There's two things worth saying as well, because people used to go, well, they're obviously faked. How are you getting all those shots of the car driving past the camera? And it's like, well, as you know,
drive it back.
Drive it back the same route and just get, you know, the director would spend a couple of days getting those shots. Yeah. And it's also worth saying that, you know, even in something like a Veyron, Jeremy couldn't drive at 200 miles an hour the whole way because the Range Rover tracking car couldn't do 200 miles an hour. So there would be a tracking car, wouldn't there? But then all of the drive-by shots would be done later.
Thank God. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got to drive across Europe in a Bugatti Veyron with a five-kilogram pot of Nutella.
I remember that. You're very proud of that.
Your Nutella. I've got a picture of you somewhere in like a French motorway service area with that pot of Nutella going...
Like a baby.
Yes.
It was, that was amazing because wherever we went, even when it was, there was no people at all, stop that car for 2 minutes, there'd be a crowd of 15 people staring at it. It was like a UFO. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of people that missed the show, the original. So where now can we find you guys? Because I mean, you've morphed on. I mean, when you're not doing impersonations of Stephen Merchant, you're also working on another car show, aren't you?
Am I? Well, I still do bits and pieces for the Grand Tour, but you know, it's just there's not a lot to do. I just go into the office.
So you're still at it with the boys?
Yeah, but it's like we go in the office. I did it recently. You just go in and, you know, we're thinking of doing something, and then it's like, well, what cars should we use? You know, and I'm still a car nerd, so I'll kind of chuck in my Temp Penneth, and then, you know, you sort of, well, we need a gag idea here, and I'll still try and come up with gags and things like that. So I do that. I have a podcast as well, Ben. I don't know if I mentioned it.
Sniff and Smith.
Good. I've never seen it, but I hear it's very good.
It's as good as my book, which you've also not read. We are Britain's number one car podcast.
That's awesome.
Unless that pesky man off Top Gear has got his podcast out, in which we sort of vie for the number one spot. But yeah, so I'm doing that with my friend Johnny Smith.
Fantastic.
And then just writing things for people.
Great books.
Thanks, Ben.
This is proper memory lane. I mean, I really enjoyed this. Second time round, and it's a cracker. And you're still back into... You're doing car years.
Yeah, the car years were on ITV4, which both of you are in.
It's
as
true.
Judges. Yep. Mm. Two presenters champion a car from a certain year, and you and other people choose a winner. I like to think it's the thinking person's car show now. Mm. So that's the car years. It's on ITVX at the minute, actually.
Oh.
The car years. It's called the car years. Alexa, play.
Car years. Jim Wiseman, one of the OG Top Gear boys, making new content.
Bringing a bit of Matt magic.
So really, everybody has found their feet in a different world. So the Top Gear DNA is spread far and wide, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's quite telling because TV is quite a fickle business and people move on from shows quite quickly, don't they, I think, generally. It's because you want to build up a good CV. So you'll do a series of something and then move on to something else. And I always remember talking to mates in TV and they'd go, so what are you up to now? I'm like, well, I'm still on Top Gear. Like, you're still on Top Gear? Mm. Like, 8 years in. It's like TV years are like dog years. That's like, why are you
doing that? You were 15 years.
Well, yeah.
Life
But it's because, I think, and you came back, didn't you?
I went away and then came back and then I came back again.
So when's the statute of limitations on your stories from that
period?
I have no idea,
but there's an absolute cracker, which... we'll come back for part two.
We'll get back to that.
But I was going to say, I think it's amazing that, well, it's not amazing, but it probably says something about the show that for all the tiredness and things like that, that it was a hell of a job and that people who worked on the show tended to stick around a long time because it was hard to think of something you'd rather do.
Yeah, especially if you're into, I was an F1 nerd, so I've done F1. But even people in F1 are like, he's the Top Gear guy, so we'll listen to him.
Yeah.
That's that's a really great thing when you're talking to F1 drivers.
I met a guy who writes like top line drama shows, real prestige stuff. And I wanted to talk to him like, how does he construct the story? What's his process? He wouldn't let me ask questions. He kept going, and when you were doing those jokes for the news section, how would those be? And I was like, why is it? And he was a very brainy guy. He's like, I can't believe that he ever watched Top Gear, but he was fascinated by it. Kind of went, it's really interesting.
There's a lot of bright people that made the show work from top down, wasn't it? Wilman, Clarkson, you guys, and that's the unsung heroes.
I just think that it was a lot of right people at the right time, and I think, and also I still think the fact that we were there just before social media, again, having been there for the next iteration where social media was fully switched on and it was just pages of bile, I think, the first series wasn't brilliant, and I think, and that was felt like a big relaunch at that point because there was the show before that, which was brilliant. Let's not take anything away from the Pebble Mill show because it was brilliant. And so I think that we got lucky, right place, right time, right people.
Mm. Perfect storm. Yeah. There's so many things that happened that, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, we were working on that show, weren't we, planning it before the first series, assuming it was just going to go out on a Thursday night, where it always had been.
Yeah.
And then the beep came to us and went, it's going to be Sunday evening. And we were like, oh, no, God's sake. Yeah. Sunday evening's like just songs of praise and then period dramas, and it's so boring. Yeah. But actually, I don't know who came up with that idea, but it was genius because suddenly we were a programme for people who didn't find anything else they wanted to watch on Sunday night, which was, it turned out, quite a lot of people. So that was great. We filled that void. Now Sunday night's quite a big night for telly, but, you know, in the Strictly final, the results are on and all that stuff. But at the time, it was a bit of a wasteland if you didn't like, you know, Nick Berry pretending to be a policeman in the 50s.
I think we should stage a comeback.
Well, it's too late now, isn't it? And the other thing was, like, the invention of YouTube came along just the right time, that people started clipping out bits of Top Gear and putting them on YouTube illegally, but it meant that people in places where Top Gear wasn't shown suddenly went, what the hell is this show?
Yeah.
And then broadcasters around the world started cottoning onto that and going, we should buy it. And that led to this, what was it, 350 million global audience, whatever, that, which I forgot. I was doing a job for, with some people recently, and there was there's some Americans there, and there's an American actor and who was in quite a big show for a while. And one of the crew, she overheard us talking and about figures, and she went, what's got that figures? And I was like, I was just a show I used to work on. And this guy said to her, Richard used to work on the biggest TV show in the world. And she went, what? I think it was because, like, what, this fuckwit used to work? But I kind of, and I went, oh, I don't think it was the biggest show in the world. And he was like, no, I'm pretty sure it was. And it's like how quickly you forget.
Yeah,
because it happened so slowly and so sort of naturally, and then suddenly it was like, oh, and nothing changed in the way we made the show, really, except we maybe got but a bit more ambitious.
It's the impact, which I've never experienced since. It's like, but now I've got, there's people who I'm working with. I've just worked with someone, he was kind of in his early 30s, and I was telling him a couple of stories, and he's like, oh, don't spoil my childhood. And you're like, oh my God. And you forget now that all the people who were at school are all in the workplace, and that's their childhood. And then there's like, you jump on YouTube, and then suddenly there was some guy who took a transit to the Nürburgring.
Oh.
And because he wanted to do that. And I was like, oh, I drove the transit to the Nürburgring for the actual shoot. And there's this kind of, this weird kind of moments in your own life career where people that you can share with it, what it turns out is literally anyone, which is nuts.
Yeah,
it's really nuts.
Yeah, we've been in everyone's living rooms for 15 years and it's a no
thing. It's an odd thing, and we're very lucky to have done it, because, you know, lots of shows don't quite get that traction for whatever reason, and so it's nice that people cared and still seem to care a little bit about it. You know, I think some of it I would not do again the same way, but there's some bits I'm quite proud of. That. Yeah. I think we did some good stuff. So.
Boys, thank you for coming on. I could listen to your stories all day. And if you've enjoyed it, leave some comments. But you too, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Next time, maybe get you on track, do something a bit different. You and Smithers, I think you need some punishment. And actually, you've never been on track either at high speed. So
never.
I have been on the track with you, though, a few times. Because there was once where we were going around the track, and I think it was like a Polo GTI, so it wasn't something mega fast, but I just remember that you went, that's where I crashed the Koenigsegg as we're going through, and I was like, put both your hands on the fucking wheel, Ben, please.
It remains on my bucket list to take you particularly, and Clarkson actually, in a fast car and properly have you on those Jesus handles praying for mercy. So, another time, another day. Richard Porter, Jim Wiseman, legends, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.